In Acts chapter 18, Paul, nearing the end of his second missionary journey, a term which we have used but is not actually used in the scriptures itself, goes to the city of Corinth. Corinth turns out to be one of four cities, four churches that Paul invests the largest amount of his time in. You think about these things with me, you realize he's already invested years of his life in the church in Antioch. We don't have a letter written to the church in Antioch. We have very little information, actually, about the specifics of the church in Antioch. And yet, Paul spent several years of his life spread out over several different occasions with the church there. In a sense, it was his home congregation, even though he was not from Antioch. A second place that Paul has spent a good deal of his time and effort was here in Corinth. By the time it's all over with, he will have spent close to, if not more than, 2 years here working with the church. After this, he will spend more than 2 years with the church in Ephesus. That's still coming. Lastly, he will spend 2 years or more with the church in Rome. All the other churches that Paul dealt with, he spent much less time with. As we think through our books in our New Testament, there's Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians. We've just mentioned those two congregations. Galatians, Paul spent fairly brief periods of time with the churches in Galatia. And yet he writes a letter to them. Ephesians, we've mentioned them. Philippians, Paul spent just a few weeks or months with them on two different occasions. And yet they were very near and dear to his heart, a thriving, mature congregation there. Colossians, the same thing with Colossae. We don't even actually have a record of Paul's visit in the book of Acts to Colossae. We have though his letter to them in which he mentions him having been with them, and we have the letter written to Philemon later. Philemon lived in Colossae. And Paul talks about when he comes back to visit again. So he had been there, and he had planned on going again, but didn't spend a great deal of time there. Thessalonians. Paul was there only 3 weeks or 4 weeks at the most, according to the record here in the book of Acts. And yet, he felt very good about the church there. He writes two letters to them to correct some problems they were having. He had sent Silas and Timothy back on more than one occasion to visit with them and help strengthen them in some things. So, Corinth is an important congregation in terms of Paul's work. These four we've mentioned, Antioch, Corinth, Ephesus, and Rome, ultimately are where the largest amount of his time in terms of his work was spent. And while we talked about the church in Corinth last week, I just remind you once again, this city of Corinth, a city of possibly 200,000 or more people, was a vibrant, alive trading city. It was located at a strategic point in which trade passed over from the west to the east and from the east to the west, just right by the city. They had seaports on either side of them, only 4.5 miles apart or so, and a large amount of cargo was transported overland from one seaport to the other. And of course, those who did the transporting lived in the city. Those who were in charge of seeing this happen lived in the city and ran those businesses. And many of those who were on the ships going from one way to the other would spend the night in the city before they would go on their way beyond that. So it had this large amount of trade. It was also a strategic place for the Romans. And so they had a significant military force there and paid a lot of attention to what was happening in Corinth. But it was also the center for the worship of Aphrodite. The Romans called her Venus, the goddess of love and sexuality. And there was a huge temple there to her worship and many smaller ones. It said that those temples employed more than 1,000 prostitutes. Now they redecorated what their real role was by calling them priestesses, but that's what they were. They were prostitutes. And they worshipped, or maybe we should say brought in revenue to the temples through the practicing of their trade. Corinth was probably the most immoral city in the entire Roman Empire. It, because of this emphasis on sexuality by their religion and this thriving, ever-changing population because of the trade, it ended up being the place where every kind of wicked and evil thing found a home. Paul will later write back to the Corinthians about the kind of background they came out of. First of all, he will say in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that not many of them were wise by human standards. Not many of them were of the well-placed upper echelon people in their society. And that's probably true. These were the lower class people, some of them probably even slaves, most of them not Roman citizens, who had been won to the gospel. But then he'll say later in chapter 6 of 1 Corinthians that he says, "Do not be deceived, neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor male prostitutes, nor homosexual offenders, nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor slanderers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God, and that is what some of you were. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God." Every one of those things mentioned there would be just the kind of thing you would find in a city like Corinth. Idolaters, they worship false gods. The sexual immorality and all those different forms he mentioned there, again, a part of that city. Those who were thieves and swindlers, lower class people, had sticky fingers oftentimes. If they were hired to help move cargo, a little less would reach the other end from where what was there when it started. It would just manage to disappear. There'd be a little shortage at the other end. People would steal. People would, because it was such a shifting population and shifting people in and out of every kind, they could swindle others out of things. They could offer to do things for them, take money for it or take goods for it and not do what they were supposed to do. That's what kind of people these were. These were not good Jewish, hardworking people who had a long history and background in what the law of God was all about, the Ten Commandments and all of those things. These are people who never in their life, most of them, had even heard the word moral before they heard the gospel. As a result, even after the church began there, many of these people struggled for a long, long time to bring their lives into conformity with the demands of the gospel. Paul will even refer to them later when he writes a letter. It'll be 3 or 4 years in the future from when we're reading right now, when he'll actually write back to them his first letter. And he refers to them as still like children in terms of their understanding of right and wrong. And even in their relationships with each other, they were suing each other in court and they were dividing up and saying, "I follow Paul," or "I follow Apollos," or "I follow Peter." Paul said, "You're acting like infants, like children." They didn't have the instant kind of maturity that some of the churches that were made up mostly of Jewish, or at least had a significant number of Jewish converts in it, who could immediately provide that kind of stability and maturity that came from having already lived all their lives trying to please God. And yet Paul invested a tremendous amount, not only of time in the almost 2 years he spends there, but in letters he writes back to them, 3 different letters. And apparently 2 additional visits back to the church. Because he knew that if the gospel could not be successful in a place like Corinth, the gospel couldn't be successful. If you had to depend on people already knowing about God and being committed to doing his will and living moral lives before the gospel ever comes to them, if you had to depend on that, then the gospel would never be able to go into all the world. So places like Corinth, it was vital that the gospel succeed there. He spent, it says in chapter 18 and in verse 9, that he even had a vision from God in the night. "Don't be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent. For I am with you and no one is going to attack and harm you because I have many people in this city." This leads us to believe that by the time Paul finally does leave, more than 18 months later, that the church there was a large church because God says, "I have many people in this city." That's in stark contrast to what happened in chapter 17 in Athens, the town Paul was in before this, where it says that a few believed. Over in Athens, where people were of the intellectual upper level of their culture, only a few accepted the gospel. But here, where you have almost the dregs of the empire, many believe. They could see the stark difference between the kind of lives they had lived and what God was calling them to. Often intellectuals rationalize in their own mind that they're already good enough. These people knew they weren't good enough. They needed the gospel. And even when finally trouble did arise, such that some of the opposers to Paul try to put him out of business, so to speak, the case comes before Gallio, the new proconsul, or governor, we might say, of that area. Proconsuls only served for a year. That was the Roman practice. Unless they were reappointed, usually they only served for 1 year in any given province before they would be transferred by the government somewhere else. This was a plan on the part of the government not only to help people keep moving up the chain of public service into higher positions, but it also kept men from being in a place long enough to gain enough support to anyway be a challenge to the emperor. Keep moving them every year. And Gallio, while he's the proconsul there, charges are brought against Paul, but Gallio, in typical best Roman fashion, throws the case out, said it has nothing to do with Roman law or whether someone's breaking the law of the empire. And so it says after that in verse, verse 18, after that case is thrown out, Paul stayed on in Corinth for some time more. So in addition to the 18 months, he's there more. But at last it's time to leave. We don't know what exactly prompted Paul's desire to leave. Perhaps just the fact he knows that the gospel needs to be preached in other places. He leaves behind a list of quite a number of men, and some women too, that he leaves behind as leaders in the church there. And some of them at times will join him in works in other places. As I look through the list, we not only have Silas and Timothy who have been working with him here for most of the last 2 years, we have Aquila and Priscilla who are going to leave with him but will come back to Corinth. He mentions Stephanas in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and again in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. He talks about the household of Stephanas is addicted, he says, to the work in Corinth. That's a very interesting word, isn't it, to describe someone's devotion to the work in a particular place, that they're addicted to it. Apparently, it wasn't just Stephanas himself. It was other than his household who also took a leading role in working with the church there. They had been converted and baptized right there in Corinth. He will mention Crispus as here in Acts 18, the former leader of the Jewish synagogue who became a Christian. And he was apparently replaced by another man then who led the Jewish synagogue for a while named Sosthenes. And yet later when Paul writes a letter back to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 1 and 1, he mentions Sosthenes is now a Christian too. And there with Paul. He mentions others as well. At the end of 1 Corinthians chapter 16, he mentions Gaius, Fortunatus, and Achaicus. I'm just mentioning all of this to say, sort of unique in all the different places Paul had been, even where he spent a lot of time, like Antioch, Ephesus, and Rome. It's only in Corinth Paul named so many co-workers who ended up working with him in that work there. And yet they had lots of problems, and that's why he had to write the two letters that we have, and one more he mentions that we don't have, to them, trying to correct problems they had. But now what's going to happen? He's going to leave. He says in 18:18, Paul stayed on in Corinth for some time more. Then he left the brothers and sailed for Syria. That's his end destination. Syria is where Antioch is, heading back to the home congregation. They probably have helped it in some ways at times to financially support him in this. But most of all, I think he also just needs to go touch base with those he's had such a long relationship with. He sailed for Syria, accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila. So this couple that he's been working with, or at least especially when he first got there, he had worked in the same business with them, they're pulling up stakes and going with him. We'll talk in just a moment about why they might have done that. But it says he's accompanied by Priscilla and Aquila before he sailed. Now he would have left Corinth and gone down to the seaport of Cenchrea. just a couple of miles from Corinth. If he's going to be sailing east, he would go there. And it says, before he sailed, he cut his hair off at Cenchrea because of a vow he had taken. As I read the scriptures, this is something that to me sort of comes out of left field. So I say, what? What's that all about? Remember, Paul, all of his life before he became a Christian, was Jewish. And even after he became a Christian, he still kept many Jewish traditions, like going to the synagogue, and at least in some places at some times, observing Sabbath day. He will even mention to the Corinthians, when he writes back to them, that he, when he was among the Jews, lived like a Jew. When he was among the Romans, he lived like a Roman. And he did that, he said, so that in some way he might be able to influence every person. I became all things to all men, that by all means I might save some. Paul has just done a very Jewish thing. He has taken what seems to be, according to the book of Numbers in the Old Testament, a Nazirite vow. Jewish men, and women I guess as well, but particularly men, would sometimes make a vow to do something, a commitment. And they wouldn't just say, I'm going to do it. They would actually go before God and make this commitment, and they would show as a sign of their commitment this cutting of their hair. Now, it's unclear to me exactly how this always was done, because it seems like the custom varied a little. Sometimes they would cut their hair at the beginning of the vow and then not cut it again until whatever they had vowed to do is completed, and then they would cut it again. Now, sometimes it might take quite some time to accomplish what you did, and so you might get quite long curly locks. Or like some of us, you wouldn't be able to tell. But Paul, it says, has taken a vow. And when he's about to get on the ship down at Cenchrea to leave for this, heading home to Antioch, he has his hair cut. We don't know that if this marks the beginning of his vow or the end. It seems like most scholars think that it probably marked the end of his vow. He's indicating that whatever vow he had made to God had been fulfilled. And they suggest, without having any evidence, but they suggest that possibly the vow he had made is that he would stay in Corinth and do God's work until the work was done. Remember when God had spoken to him and says, don't be afraid, don't quit speaking, I've got many people in this city. Perhaps that prompted Paul to pledge to God that as long as God would protect him, that he would stay there and work until the work was done. But now there's a little extra thing involved. If you're going to do a Nazirite vow and you're Jewish, at the end of the vow, you cut your hair, but the law said within 30 days of the completion of the vow and the cutting of your hair, you had to offer a sacrifice at the temple. And along with the sacrifice, you had to bring the hair that you cut and offer that to God too. It was sort of an evidence, as if God needed it, that you've fulfilled your vow to him. Well, if Paul has now completed his vow and he's cut his hair in Cenchrea, he has 30 days to get to Jerusalem if he's going to keep Jewish tradition. And so it says that before they sailed, he cuts his hair. So the clock is now ticking. They arrived at Ephesus, where Paul left Priscilla and Aquila. This means they're not going to continue on the journey with him. They're going to now stay in Ephesus. Some have suggested things were not financially good in Corinth. And Paul would even say later in his letter to the Corinthians that he often did without while he was working there, which might indicate that he didn't make a very good living. That might have been true of Priscilla and Aquila as well. So maybe just for financial or business reasons, they've moved to Ephesus. But I like to believe that Paul is already preparing for his next place to work. And Priscilla and Aquila go with him, and he leaves them in Ephesus now to start preparing the ground for when he will come again. And look what it tells us about this. He himself went into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to spend more time with them, he declined. Why? He's got to get to Jerusalem. He's got to keep his vow. A part of keeping the vow was even what happened after the vow was over. And he's made this commitment to God. He needs, if by all means possible, to get to Jerusalem. So he declined. But as he left, he promised, I will come back if it is God's will. Then he set sail from Ephesus. And I have there on page 2 of your bulletin, if you have it with you and want to look at it, you can see how they've drawn the line there from Ephesus and how he sails by ship down to Caesarea. Caesarea was that Roman fortress city on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean where the governor of Judea, the Roman governor of Judea, had his headquarters, and a full legion of troops were usually stationed to keep peace in that part of the country. But it says there that he lands at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church, and then went down to Antioch. And our way of thinking, we usually think of things up as north and things down as south. But they didn't have that way of thinking. To them, something, you went up to something if it was of higher elevation, and you went down to something if it's lower elevation. Obviously, Caesarea is at sea level. It's right on the shores of the Mediterranean. But if you travel to Jerusalem, you'd be going up because you'd be going up to almost 3,000 feet above sea level in a distance of about 65 miles. So it says he went up and greeted the church. That would also give him the opportunity to fulfill his vow by making an offering at the temple. This would also have another benefit. Remember, the church in Jerusalem is almost entirely Jewish. And even though we had the meeting back in Acts chapter 15 where they decided that Gentiles didn't have to keep the law like the Jews still wanted to do, even as Christians and so forth, the Jewish Christians and the Jewish Christian leadership was always, I think, a little uncomfortable with Paul because he just didn't act quite Jewish enough most of the time because of that aforementioned thing that, you know, when he was with the Jews, he acted like a Jew, and when he was with the Greeks, he acted like a Greek, and when he was with the Romans, he acted like a Roman. So when Paul comes up to the church there, not only does he fulfill his vow and make the offering at the temple and present his hair and so forth, but this allowed the church there in Jerusalem to see him and see that he was still keeping Jewish custom. This will pop up again in Acts chapter 21 when he comes back after his next missionary journey. And the elders in the church in Jerusalem will actually ask him to go with some of the men in the congregation up to the temple and help them fulfill their vows. And Paul actually pay the cost of the sacrifices. And they said this would help all the church to know that you are still honoring the law. So I think this is what's happening here. When Paul leaves Ephesus and he lets the church, the few brethren that are there right at that time, we don't know how the church actually started in Ephesus. This is Paul's first time there. He had been prevented back in chapter 16 by the Holy Spirit from going there. Remember back when it said the Holy Spirit wouldn't let him go into Asia? Ephesus was the capital of Asia. But now here he is. But now he's here and he can't stay. But he says, if it's Lord's will, I'll be back. He leaves Priscilla and Aquila behind to start taking care of making things more suitable for his return there, I think. And we will see him back there pretty shortly. But so it says, he greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. And while Luke gives us precious little details about this, it does say in verse 23, after spending some time in Antioch, Paul set out from there and traveled from place to place throughout the region of Galatia and Phrygia, strengthening all the disciples. So after Paul spends a while back in Antioch, Luke sort of just looks ahead a little bit and lets us know that eventually he'll leave Antioch again and follow the same path he followed on his second missionary journey. This is his third one already beginning. But on his second one, he'll travel around into Cilicia, where Tarsus and so forth was his hometown, and travel back again into that area where Lyconium and Derbe and Lystra and Antioch of Pisidia is located. And he'll pass through all those places again because he's already begun his third missionary journey. But meanwhile, verse 24, and it literally uses the word meanwhile, doesn't it? Meanwhile, it says, a Jew named Apollos, a native of Alexandria, came to Ephesus. And if you look on your map, if you look way down at the bottom of the map, you see where Egypt is. That's where Alexandria is located. So here's a man who's traveled from Alexandria up to Ephesus. So a native of Alexandria came to Ephesus. He was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the Scriptures. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John. And so while Priscilla and Aquila are there, Paul's not present. The small church they're working with, and apparently they're still closely connected to the Jewish synagogue, because apparently the Christian believers there in Ephesus haven't been kicked out of the synagogue yet. Here's this man arrives from Alexandria. Alexandria was one of the four university cities of the ancient Roman Empire. Athens was a preeminent one. Paul's already been there. Tarsus is another. Paul's hometown, a university city. People came from all over to study at Tarsus. Antioch, where Paul is now, a university city, and Alexandria. I don't think it's any mistake that Paul made it to three of those places. He recognized the gospel needed to go to educated people too. But Alexandria is down in Egypt, and it had been a center of education long before the Roman Empire was prominent, when the Greeks were still running the empire. And in fact, it was in Alexandria where the largest number of Jewish people lived outside of the Holy Land itself. More Jews lived in Alexandria than any other place other than Jerusalem. And it was there, in about 215 BC, that very educated, scholarly Jewish men had gotten together and translated the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. Because more and more, even Jewish people couldn't read Hebrew anymore. Those who lived outside of Judea had gradually taken on the sort of the universal language of the Greek Empire, which was Greek. And so these Jewish scholars had gotten together in Alexandria and had translated the Bible into Greek. That translation is referred to as a Septuagint. Most of the time in the New Testament, when we hear Matthew or Mark or Luke or John or Paul or James or Peter, when we hear them quoting the Old Testament, they're quoting the Septuagint, not the Hebrew Bible. That's how influential that translation was. Alexandria was the center not only for scholarship among Greek people, but among Jewish people. There were more educated Jewish people in Alexandria than there were in Jerusalem. They might have been more zealous in Jerusalem, but not more educated. And here a man comes from Alexandria, as it says, a very learned man with a thorough knowledge of the Scriptures. As far as I could think of in the New Testament, there was only one other person who was in some way similarly described as Apollos was, as far as his education was concerned, and that was Paul himself. I'm sure there were many others, but these two in particular really stand out. And this man has come from Alexandria, and he's come to the Jewish synagogue. He's unaware of Priscilla, Aquila, Paul, and their work. But he comes there, and what does he want to talk about in the synagogue in Ephesus? He wants to talk about Jesus. He wants to tell them about Jesus. And how did he learn about Jesus? He learned about Jesus from John the Baptist, either directly or indirectly. Perhaps Apollos had actually made a trip to the Holy Land during the ministry of John the Baptist and had been taught by him and came to believe what John was teaching. If not that, then certainly someone who had been taught by John got as far as Alexandria and Apollos was persuaded. We don't know which would be the case. But there was a problem. As much as Apollos believed that Jesus was the Messiah that was to come, he didn't know the whole story yet. His knowledge came before the story was complete. Imagine, if you will, and I'm just saying for instance, if Apollos himself had traveled from Alexandria around to Jerusalem, that wasn't a long, difficult journey as compared to some of the journeys Paul made. If he came back to his roots in Jerusalem to worship at the temple, he hears about this man, John the Baptizer, out there near Jordan River preaching and teaching, and he goes out to hear him, and he is persuaded What would he then know? He would know that John would say, I'm not the Messiah, but I'm the forerunner who's going just ahead of him. He would know that John had said, look, there's the Lamb of God who's going to take away the sins of the world. But that's what John said on more than one occasion, pointing at Jesus. He would know that John had said, I didn't know for sure it was him until when I baptized him, the voice spoke from heaven and told me. Then Apollos would have the opportunity, learning under John, to go back and look at all those Old Testament scriptures and find out he had been born in Bethlehem, a son of David. All the prophecies that had been made that had been fulfilled in that first part of Jesus' life. But then Apollos goes home. John goes into prison and is eventually executed. But Apollos starts teaching the other Jews down in Alexandria that the Messiah has come. His name is Jesus. But here we are, 20 years plus later, after Jesus himself was crucified, rose from the dead, and went back to heaven. And Apollos, and some others too, we'll soon discover, don't know about any of that, even 20 years later. They just know what John taught about Jesus. And they're excited about that even 20 years later. And so this man is. And with great fervency and great boldness, it says that he speaks to the Jews in the synagogue there at Ephesus about Jesus. And what he taught them was accurate, it says. But it was incomplete because he didn't have the rest of the story yet. He had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and he spoke with great fervor and taught about Jesus accurately, though he knew only the baptism of John, which means he didn't know yet that Jesus had also, in the Great Commission, commissioned those who knew about his death and resurrection to go out and preach that good news. He's just preaching the good news from John's standpoint. He began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they invited him to their home and explained to him the way of God more accurately. I looked up that particular Greek word here, akrabos, in the Greek, and it's translated a number of different ways in the New Testament. It's translated by the word carefully. In other words, they explained the way of God carefully to him. Or I like this one. Over in Acts chapter 23, the Roman captain that had taken Paul into custody in order to try to check out exactly what the charges were the Jews were making against him said, we need to make a thorough investigation. And yet in the Greek, it's the word akrabos. So they took Apollos and did a thorough investigation with him concerning Jesus. In Acts chapter 24, the same word is translated by three English words, more exact knowledge. When someone says, we need more exact knowledge about these things that are being said about Paul, here, Priscilla and Aquila give Apollos more exact knowledge about Jesus. Because now they can say, let's tell you like Paul Harvey says the rest of the story. And all that does is just make Apollos even more excited and more fervent and more bold in his message. Here's a man different than many of the Jews that they had encountered who wants to know everything he can about Jesus. And as soon as he learns it, it becomes a part of what he wants to tell everyone else. And it says then in verse 27 that Apollos wanted to go on to Achaia. Now, Paul, Priscilla, and Aquila just came from Achaia. Achaia is where Athens, Centria, and Corinth is located. Now, he wants to go back over there. Perhaps he's heard from Priscilla and Aquila about the church there and feels like he can do some good over there because they had great opposition from the Jews in the synagogue over there. Maybe he thinks he can do what others had not been able to do. When Apollos wanted to go to Achaia, the brothers encouraged him and wrote to the disciples there to welcome him. On arriving, he was a great help to those who by grace had believed, for he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. So here's this very educated, highly respected, probably had all sorts of credentials and even documentation and paperwork to show that he had come from Alexandria and had the approval of the Jewish scholars down there, and yet he's teaching about Jesus. That gave him a special in to talk to the Jews in Corinth. And so he does with great vigor. and proving from the Scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. Well, that brings our chapter to the end and our lesson for this morning. But just three little things I pull out of this very quickly. First of all, having to do with Paul's vow. While we don't know exactly the specifics of what the vow was about, I strongly think that it had something to do with how God had delivered and protected him and made it possible for him to be effective in preaching the gospel there in Corinth. We as human beings have a strong tendency to fervently pray that God will help us do something, and then when he does, we forget to thank him for it. Not so Paul. He even bound himself with an old traditional Jewish vow that he was bound to fulfill. I think to honor God. That's what the vow was all about. It was to honor God by showing that God had done his part and you had done your part, and now you want to thank him for it. Secondly, Priscilla and Aquila. Look what they've done. They've already left Rome for Corinth, and now they left Corinth for Ephesus. And when Paul shows back up about a year to a year and a half later, they're still there apparently working. And he'll rejoin them. Whether it was financial or other reasons they had to leave Corinth, I like to think it was actually spiritual reasons. But whatever the case might be, we discover that God would use them wherever they were as long as they were available to be used. They showed up in this new city, new for them, at Ephesus. They start worshiping with the other Jews in the synagogue, even while practicing their Christian faith. And lo and behold, God put someone into their hands that they can make all the difference in the world to. That was no accident. God will use us wherever we find ourselves, if we are willing to be used. Sometimes we wish we were somewhere else because we think the grass is greener somewhere else, but not in God's kingdom. God can use us wherever we are. Thirdly, Apollos. This man who was very gifted, and yet he wanted and was committed to using this gift of knowledge and scholarship that he had for God's purposes, not to advance himself. He gets mentioned several more times in the Scriptures as a result. Paul later, about 3 years later, when he writes his first letter to the Corinthians, will complain to them, actually correct them, because some of them are saying, "I am of Apollos." And Paul said, "Look, neither I nor Apollos or Peter died for you. You're supposed to all be of the Lord Jesus Christ." And yet that shows what influence he had had over there. Later, Paul will say at the end of, I think, 1 Corinthians chapter 16, he will say, "I encourage Apollos to come to you again, but he didn't want to do so right now, though he says he will come later." It looks like Apollos didn't want to have any part in this partyism either. He wasn't willing to give them what those who were of his party would have wanted him to show back up again until things got straightened out. And even at the very end, in Titus chapter 3, which is one of the last letters Paul writes to Titus, and he says, "When Apollos comes to you there in Crete, receive him." So apparently Apollos continued his work in the spreading of the gospel far beyond just Corinth itself. Apollos was willing to use his giftedness for God's cause, not for his own gain. Okay, we have our invitation song. The gospel was a powerful instrument for changing people's lives. And yet Paul said while he was in Corinth that he came to them in weakness and in fear. And he didn't come with powerful, eloquent words like men would use, and like maybe even Apollos could use. But he simply told them the news about Jesus Christ and him crucified. And yet they had been changed because of that. They therefore couldn't at all say it was because of persuasive words of men, but rather by the truth of the gospel itself, that their lives had turned for the better.